The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we'll begin today with the story, America Isn't Sweating Climate Change, written by Joshua Partlow. Summer has begun, which is to say wildfires in the West are chasing residents from their homes. The snowpack has dwindled to near record lows in several states. Drought is spreading, and temperatures are regularly exploring new heights. Yet America does not seem to be sweating climate change. You could call it climate hushing, as Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and others do, or a, quote, worry gap, end quote, as one study has. Whatever you call it, America's interest in talking about climate change is at an ebb. Certainly the Trump administration has made a point of disregarding climate change. Yet when President Trump made similar moves in his first term, he was met by a surge of resistance. Environmentalists and Democratic politicians formed their own climate alliances and pushed through state and local laws designed to take carbon out of the American economies. At the time, Jay Inslee, then the Washington governor, said, "We governors are going to step into this cockpit and fly the plane." These days, Democrats and even climate activists are acting as if fighting to slow global warming, let alone campaigning on it, is passé. As gas prices soared during the Iran war, blue state governors have given fossil fuels another look, pushing the message of affordability, debating new gas pipelines, and putting off, in some cases, commitments to cut emissions. California's frontrunner for governor, Xavier Becerra, who took campaign donations from oil companies, has not committed to phasing out gas cars, as the state has planned. New York Governor Kathy Hochul rolled back the state's landmark 2019 climate law. Congressional Democrats, who need to win seats during the midterms, are focused on economic issues. Look at the Senate map. Jane Fliegel, a senior fellow at the Searchlight Institute, a moderate Democratic think tank, told me, "I mean, Alaska, Texas, Iowa, these are not places where anyone with brain cells would say, run on blocking fossil fuels and addressing the climate crisis." Many of the climate activists who came of age during Trump's first term have since broadened their portfolio. The most famous one, Greta Thunberg, posts about Gaza and ICE raids alongside her critiques of the fossil fuel industry. The Sunrise Movement, the youth-led group that championed the Green New Deal, has pivoted to defeating authoritarianism as a prerequisite for passing climate legislation. Aru Shipney Ajay, the group's executive director, told me. Her organization was still hopeful, she said, early in the second Trump administration, that they could mobilize support among Republicans to save some of the funding for renewable energy and climate-related projects. But they quickly saw that wouldn't happen. The Trump administration has pushed to expand oil drilling, including in sensitive Alaskan wilderness and California coastal waters, to block offshore wind farms, to stop regulating greenhouse gas pollution, an effort EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin described last year as, quote, driving a dagger straight into the heart of the climate change religion, end quote. While Democrats and environmentalists have challenged such actions in court, the public hasn't made much noise about them, and some advocates fear that these kind of rollbacks could be gathering their own quiet momentum, even in Democratic strongholds. John Binder, the executive director of the Model Climate Laws Initiative at Columbia University, told me. Some environmentalists are more optimistic that the ever-improving economics of clean energy can keep tamping down emissions. They see the need to expand the electricity grid, if mainly to feed the hyperscale data centers, as an opportunity to add wind and solar energy. And yet, the people who think most about climate seem immobilized. It's the responsibility of the environmental community to elucidate what's going on, Catherine Phillips, a longtime California environmental advocate, told me. But somehow, they're stuck. The people still trying to make noise about climate worry that this phase of climate hushing doesn't actually reflect what Americans want. Voters care deeply about the growing risks of floods and wildfires, White House told me, and about the rising cost of homeowners insurance and the threat that poses to the wider economy. But how politicians talk about these issues matters, he said. You're getting screwed and your bills are going up because of the fossil fuel industry, is a much more powerful and salient argument than setting future climate targets without a way to get to them. Voters in Rhode Island, where White House is from, are not exactly on the same page about these questions as voters in, say, Texas, but he might be right that Americans want something more from their leaders on this issue. Jennifer Marlin, a climate scientist at Yale University, which has long polled Americans about the climate, told me that a majority of people do want their politicians to take action on climate change. What's changing is leadership, she said. A lot of leaders are thinking, oh, I'm going to get in trouble if I talk about it, or it's too polarizing. It's turning into this vicious circle. Fewer people, in rich countries at least, appear to be dwelling on the perils of a warming planet. In the U.S., just more than half of the respondents, 51%, to a new Lloyd's Register Foundation World Risk Poll conducted by Gallup, considered climate, quote, a very serious threat, end quote, over the next 20 years. The poll also found that people tended to underestimate how worried their peers were. Only 10% of Americans thought most other people here saw climate as a real threat. And that makes sense on some level. If only a bare majority of Americans are that worried about climate, even those who might reasonably question the country's collective concern. Marlin, the Yale scientist, has found, too, that in much of the country, people don't worry enough about the real issues they face. One of her recent studies mapped heat risk across the country, as determined by the CDC, and compared it with survey results about how worried people are about the extreme heat. Apart from the Southwest, where the lethal dangers of heat are well documented and discussed, the level of concern among the public in much of the country lags behind the expert assessments of the risk. Few places, her study found, face a greater threat from heat, while residents worry about it less, than a swath of rural counties in Oregon, three of the top 10 counties in the country with the greatest worry gap were in that state. Virginia also had three in that group. The finding made me wonder what it feels like out there where climate threats abound, but nobody stresses too much. A place like that seemed pretty in sync with our country at the moment. I drove out to Gilliam County, population 2,000, last week, number 4 on the worry gap list, on what happened to be the hottest day of the year so far. Thick smoke from a wildfire drifted over the Columbia River into this swath of north-central Oregon. By the next evening, authorities had ordered more than 10,000 people to evacuate as another fire burned through parts of Spokane. One person died. Temperature records would break that day in Portland and in other cities across the Pacific Northwest. The state had just declared a drought emergency for Gilliam County, along with nearly half of Oregon's counties. Amid the dry land wheat fields and sagebrush hills where Trump won handily the past three elections, the residents I spoke with were keenly attuned to the conditions of the soil and the changes in the air. In Condon, the county seat, Gibb Wilkins, the interim city administrator and public works superintendent, told me he was focused on trying to get the community to conserve water to avoid mandatory restrictions. The winter's scant snow has stressed water supplies across the West. Condon did not run its snowplows once, when it normally might do so a dozen times. Wilkins is also the town's nighttime snowplow driver. His public works crews that day were out mowing grass in case they needed to build proper fire breaks later this summer. These employees are older. The town's median age is more than 60, and he's had to pull some of them off the job on particularly hot days. "We're not cooling off like we used to at night," he said. If people did not express worry to an official survey taker, he suggested, it probably has to do with the hardiness and resolve of the residents, many of them farmers who have weathered a lifetime of lashing from the elements. A lot of people here survived the farm downturns of the 80s, and they just see it as another obstacle they've got to overcome, Wilkins said. So maybe people just adapt without complaining. With the morning temperature in the mid-80s and rising, Mark Griffith was kneeling on the patio outside the Elks Club, spreading concrete. The 66-year-old cowboy and construction worker has spent a life outside here. "I enjoy it," he told me. "It gets a little hot for moving cows around and stuff." He'd noticed the fire season seems to be starting earlier, he said, in June or even May. And he's noticed that the 4-foot snowfalls he'd seen as a kid back in the 60s and 70s had disappeared. "We're definitely seeing a change in the environment, for sure," he says. "What causes it? I don't know. I'm sure man caused a lot of it, you know. We ruin just about everything we touch." He knelt back to his work, positioning a metal pole. He was building a sunshade. Our second story. SpaceX just needs the money. What this year of humongous IPOs says about the tech industry. This was written by James Sorowicki. This is the year of the Giga IPO. SpaceX, Elon Musk's aerospace and artificial intelligence company, raised a record $75 billion in capital when it went public earlier this month, instantly becoming one of the 10 most valuable companies in the world. The AI giants Anthropic and OpenAI, meanwhile, both recently filed to go public later this year, ensuring that in a matter of months, we will likely witness the three biggest IPOs in history. These massive IPOs are outliers in other ways, too. The number of businesses going public has been shrinking dramatically, from more than 500 or so a year in the 1990s to about 120 a year over the past decade. Although the number of new businesses in the United States has surged in recent years, the number of public companies is down by almost 40% from its 1990s peak. So why are these buzzy companies in the hottest industry bucking this trend and going public? The answer is simple. Because they need to raise staggering amounts of money to cover the enormous cost of competing in the AI race. This marks a fundamental change in the technology business. Many tech giants of recent decades, think Facebook, Uber, and Airbnb, went public less to raise money than to give their early investors and employees a chance to cash out by selling stock. Although software and internet-based companies invested plenty in research and development, their capital expenditures were otherwise low. They built massive and massively profitable businesses without much in the way of upfront costs. Even Amazon's profits came mostly from its web services business, not from retail. At the same time, a boom in venture capital and private investment funds allowed founders to raise money without subjecting themselves to the regulatory and reporting requirements of public companies. But developing AI is ludicrously expensive. SpaceX's AI business, for instance, is burning through $1 billion every month. OpenAI lost a reported $38.5 billion last year, according to the financial statements uncovered by blogger Ed Zetron. These companies are consuming capital at a record pace to build out data centers. And in SpaceX's case, all the other stuff that Elon Musk wants to make. Although SpaceX has had no shortage of private investors, the company just got masses of cash by capitalizing on record-high investor demand. And because these companies are not yet profitable, and likely won't be for a while, they are relying on the public's hunger to get in on the AI boom to raise the tens of billions of dollars they need, and to allow some employees and early investors to cash out. Since 2003, companies have returned more money to shareholders than they have raised in the stock market. But that trend now appears to be reversing. Pretty much every big tech company is investing ungodly sums simply to be relevant in the age of AI. Even profitable companies are pouring much of their revenue back into their businesses, and they're now starting to tap the stock market, too. Alphabet, Google's parent company and one of the most profitable companies in the world, recently announced that it would be selling new stock to the public to raise $85 billion, all of it earmarked for AI. In February, the tech giant Oracle said that it would be selling $20 billion in stock. And earlier this month, the Financial Times reported that Meta, too, is contemplating a big stock offering. J.P. Morgan Chase estimates that companies will sell $1.5 trillion in shares over the next 2 years. Historically, this combination of a wave of IPOs and a rise in existing companies issuing more stock has not boded well for stocks in the long term. In many cases, a big surge in stock supply overwhelms demand and raises questions about whether markets are properly reflecting value or inflating a bubble. As the economist and hedge fund manager Owen Lamont has written, when firms are selling, you should generally sell as well. The volatility of SpaceX stock, which has tumbled for days, erasing nearly all of the gains enjoyed by the average investor, shows just how much uncertainty attends even the most hyped stock offerings in a risky industry. The SpaceX, Anthropic, and OpenAI IPOs and the stock sales by the Googles and Oracles of the world are happening because companies are trying to raise as much money as possible while the good times last. And that should make us wonder about how much longer they will. Next, the AI super PACs trying to influence the midterms. This is written by Will Gottsagen. This is an edition of the Atlantic Daily newsletter. OpenAI's CEO signed a letter in 2023 acknowledging that AI might cause human beings to go extinct. More recently, Anthropic's CEO said that AI will, quote, test us as a species, end quote. Many Americans seem to believe them. A March poll showed that the majority of voters think the risks of a technology outweigh the benefits. Now, as the midterm elections approach, tech-affiliated super political action committees, or PACs, are investing tens of millions of dollars to try to overcome that animus. To study their strategy, think back just a few short years to a playbook established by the cryptocurrency industry. During the 2024 election cycle, crypto and venture capital firms poured funds into a super PAC called Fair Shake, which spent hundreds of millions of dollars supporting pro-crypto candidates and attempting to undercut anti-crypto candidates. The plan worked. Major politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, supported by Fair Shake and its affiliate PACs, defeated their opponents. Congress became marginally more accepting of crypto, and the industry notched several major policy wins the following year. AI-backed super PAC groups are now adopting Fairshake's model, but under profoundly different circumstances. About half of American adults say they use chatbots, such as ChatGPT, whereas just under one-fifth say they've used or invested in crypto. AI is both ubiquitous and largely distrusted. No leading candidates are advocating for a ban. Instead, the question is how the industry ought to be regulated. Two super PAC groups offer two different answers. One, Leading the Future, which was co-founded by the venture capital powerhouse Andreessen Horowitz, has embraced a regulation-light approach to AI, focusing on, quote, identifying, maintaining, and growing pro-AI candidates, end quote. It has raised more than $140 million, receiving contributions from the VC firm's founders, as well as OpenAI President Greg Brockman. Leading the Future's priorities seem to align with those of OpenAI. The AI firm recently put out a statement distancing itself from the super PAC. Meanwhile, OpenAI's main rival, Anthropic, donated $20 million to the competition. Public First Action, a nonprofit that works with super PACs to back candidates who have a focus on AI safety. Anthropic has stated that its donation is reserved exclusively for the group's AI education initiatives and cannot be used for federal election activity. The group touts its support of comprehensive regulation over the move fast and break things approach. It's in line with how Anthropic has described its priorities. The company has always positioned itself as a humane, safety-focused alternative to first-mover OpenAI, and was recently blacklisted by Pete Hegseth's Department of Defense after it refused to remove guardrails from one of its AI models. The company is currently suing the government. One of Public First Action's co-founders described it as the anti-super PAC super PAC, purely a way to counter Leading the Future and its Donald Trump-aligned donors. A high-profile battle between the two has been playing out in New York's 12th Congressional District. Alex Boris, one of the leading candidates, is a former Palantir employee who left the company after it renewed its contract with ICE. He's been running as a candidate who knows how to regulate big tech because he understands its power. Leading the Future's ads have blasted him for his focus on regulation, calling him a hypocrite who will stifle AI's progress. Politico calculates that groups affiliated with the tech industry have spent $26 million to ensure that Boris doesn't win. Meanwhile, Public First Action and other aligned groups have spent $18 million to back him. The political strategist Cooper Tabo told me that the New York race will be viewed as the final exam for this model of AI-backed political spending. If Leading the Future wins out and Boris loses, the super PAC could double down on its playbook in future races. So far, Leading the Future's spending has arguably given Boris more attention and has in some ways bolstered his appeal to AI-critical voters. One of his own campaign ads satirizes an AI super PAC with an evil-sounding robot voice that is trying to destroy him. The ad paints Boris as a level-headed alternative. As the midterms approach, debates over AI have intensified. Last month, when the commencement speakers at the University of Central Florida, the University of Arizona, and Middle Tennessee State University began to talk about AI's importance in graduates' lives, they were met with loud boos. It's worth watching video clips from the events to get a sense of the ambient feeling. These kids hate AI. People are especially skeptical of data centers. 7 out of 10 Americans don't want to see one built in their area. And the conversation has lately escalated into violence. 2 months ago, an Indiana politician's home was fired at 13 times, and a handwritten note reading, "No data centers," was left on his doorstep. The industry seems to be realizing that supersized personalities such as OpenAI's Sam Altman and Anthropic's Dario Amodei, who tend to speak about AI's potential in extreme terms, aren't necessarily equipped to represent the tech to worried voters. The fight over AI regulation has the potential to affect nearly everyone in American society. How should AI's processing power be taxed? Will data centers ultimately subsidize the restoration of the country's electrical grid? What towns should allow data centers to be built, and which shouldn't? Voters will decide, but the industry and its money will be guiding the conversation. Next, another top general is out at the Pentagon, written by Nancy A. Youssef and Missy Ryan. General Chris C.D. Donahue was the last U.S. soldier to leave Afghanistan during the chaotic 2021 withdrawal. As the head of the Army forces in Europe and Africa, he has helped bolster Ukraine in its fight to repel the Russian invasion. Now Donahue has become the latest casualty in Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's purge of military senior ranks. Donahue would be at least the sixth 3- or 4-star general to depart unexpectedly out of roughly 60 generals in the service who hold these ranks. They include the well-regarded General James Mingus, a former Army Secretary Vice Chief of Staff. It's interesting that the guy who says he wants to bring back the warrior culture is expunging the biggest warriors in Army ranks, one retired Army officer told us. This is not a war on woke. This is a war on warriors. The departures in the most senior ranks have become so frequent and sudden that Senate Democrats added a line in the latest Pentagon budget proposal calling for congressional notification before officer promotions are delayed or withheld. Donahue's deputy Major General Christopher Norrie will serve as acting commander when Donahue departs, people familiar with the matter told us. Lieutenant General Kevin Admiral, who is expected to be the administration's candidate to replace Donahue, they said, has yet to be nominated. I had to edit that last article as we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.